Nation.
Last night, the government of North Korea proclaimed to the world that it had conducted a nuclear test.
From pariah state to state of concern, North Korea may have gone nuclear.
There really could be a nuclear war in Northeast Asia. You have to now focus on this problem much more, and this test scares people.
How to limit the fallout and prevent the next nuclear nation. A nuclear North Korea, tonight on The Debate. And playing the China card. Could only Nixon have gone to China? Historian Margaret McMillan on The Week That Changed the World. Nixon in China and preventing proliferation. That's tonight on The Agenda.
The Agenda with Steve Pakin.
Good evening, everybody, and thanks for joining us. Joining us now in Edmonton, Wenren Jiang, director of the China Institute at the University of Alberta. In Hamilton, former Canadian diplomat Charles Burton. And here in Toronto, David DeWitt of York University, Brian Milner from the editorial board of the Globe and Mail, and Oral Braun from the University of Toronto. Welcome, everybody. Wenren Jiang in Edmonton, I want to go to you first. They have said that they have done it. How do we know that they've done it?
Well, supposedly they have about 1,000 to 1,500 tons of TNT explosion equivalent, according to Russian report. That's a lot of TNT if you put conventional stuff into the deep tunnel and just to fake it. So I think it's a small-scale nuclear device concealed, as they reported and conducted. It might be just that scale.
Well, let's take a look. Michael, if we could, let's bring a map up here and we'll show you the Far East. We have a couple of things to show. Number one, you can see on the left-hand side, the western side of North Korea, these are the sites where the uranium, we're told, has been enriched. And then, of course, up in the north where that star is, where the blast, in fact, took place. However, Charles Burton, North Korea says they exploded a 4-kiloton bomb. The United States estimates it was about a 0.5 kiloton. And then, in fact, it could be as little as 400 tons. So do we really know that they exploded a nuclear device tonight?
Well, we don't. I mean, they haven't been able to assess whether there's radiation in the vicinity. It seems to me likely that they have, but I wouldn't put it past them to try and fake this one. North Korea is always full of surprises.
David DeWitt, do you think this explosion is weaponized?
Well, it certainly has the potential.
It does.
And the big question that many would be concerned with is, what are the next steps before it can be put on some kind of a launching facility, a missile, or some other delivery device?
So at the moment, they just exploded it underground.
They exploded it underground, and the real issue, I think, is not whether they have or they haven't, but if they claim they have and they want to pursue it for diplomatic means, and so long as there's some uncertainty from the British, from the Russians, from the Chinese, and now from the Americans on what they've really done, it still puts them in the driver's seat on playing nuclear politics.
Oral Braun, you heard Charles Burton a moment ago say that who knows with the North Koreans, it could be a ruse, you never know. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a very important point that he made, and that is that we know very little about North Korea. We should not pretend we know a great deal. We should not pretend that we know exactly what they're thinking, what they react to, how they will behave in the future. I think we are all speculating, and in the case of the weapon itself, it doesn't have to be used on a missile. The danger with North Korea is that virtually all of the weapons that they produce, they sold eventually to someone. And if they can sell this to a terrorist group, and they've been desperate, this can be taken in containers in the United States. It can be used by those groups in other parts of the world. This is where the enormous danger is. Not just that of proliferation in the sense that North Korea has nuclear weapons, but also what it does with it. This is what makes North Korea different from other states.
More on that in a bit. Brian Milner, let's ask the very obvious and basic question. Why would they do this?
Because it works for them. They've been using the threat of developing a nuclear weapon for some time, and it's ever since the current dictator, Kim Jong-il, took over in 1994. He's been doing this, and each time it gets him something, either direct aid or a better deal from the Americans, or he makes the Japanese nervous, or even makes the Chinese nervous now, which is useful for him politically.
Let me read you a comment from John McCain today, the very influential senator from Arizona, Republican, many people think will be the Republican Party's nominee for president next time out. Here's what he had to say today. He said, I would remind Senator Hillary Clinton and other Democrats critical of the Bush administration's policies that the framework agreement her husband's administration negotiated was a failure. The Koreans received millions and millions in energy assistance. They've diverted millions of dollars of food assistance to their military. This takes us, Wen Rengzheng, to the 1994 agreement that the Clinton administration thought it had with North Korea. What was in that agreement, essentially?
Essentially, it was a crisis in 1993 that triggered the negotiation between the United States and North Korea. And the Clinton administration eventually decided it's the best approach to engage North Koreans rather than using other means, although the Clinton administration did put on a very clear show of force. Otherwise, in other words, they will use force. So the North Koreans actually came back to the table. They reached an agreement in exchange for aid, fuel, and potentially two lightweight nuclear reactors for supplying North Koreans with nuclear technology, not technology, but electricity. Then the North Koreans will suspend this program of nuclear weapons and eventually dismantle them, and plus having normal relations with the United States. Of course, by 2000, when the new Bush administration came to power, they discontinued that program. So they blame on the Democrats. Now Democrats blame on the Republicans, both sides claiming each other's policies are a failure. But we can see whichever way the policy has failed.
Charles Burton, can we know why the North Koreans chose not to live up to their part of the bargain?
Well, I think that one problem was the Americans didn't live up to their side of the deal. Congress had difficulty allocating the appropriate funds. The diplomatic recognition didn't come through, and that diplomatic recognition would have made a big difference, because the regime in North Korea is based on the idea of facing imminent attack from the U.S. That's what the people believe. And so if they had diplomatic relations, that would delegitimize the crisis situation that the regime thrives on. And of course, at the end of 2000, there was speculation that President Clinton would visit North Korea, but due to the hanging chads problem with the election, it was decided he should stick around the United States, and that opportunity was lost.
And Charles, on top of that, the American Congress impeded the flow of fuel to North Korea. So not only were the two promised light water reactors well behind their production dates, but that the oil that was supposed to be coming until those came on board was not forthcoming to the North Koreans. So the North Koreans felt aggrieved, and that the Americans were trying to take advantage of them.
Did they have a right to feel aggrieved?
Well, there's a fair amount of evidence to suggest that they did. On the other hand, they had established that there was something under the General Framework Agreement called CATO, the Korean Energy Development Organization, which was for some time a remarkably creative process of bringing, I think, Charles, it was 11 countries that came on board initially, primarily South Korea, Japan, and the United States as the executive, to really manage this process. And what we have to remember during that period of the 1990s, including the latter part of the Clinton administration, there was not just those few countries, but many in the West, including Canada, who had decided that the best way to move what was happening in North Korea forward was to try and get the North Koreans to more comfortably engage the international community and not feel threatened by it. And this was all part of that process.
So, Charles Burton, do you think Western countries, and I guess the United States in particular, how much responsibility do they have to take for where we're at today?
Well, I don't think we can say that the United States is responsible for North Korea being a rogue state. But, you know, I think that there was an assumption on the part of the Clinton administration at the time, and some of the officials in retirement have written some memoirs, that the regime was going to collapse, and therefore the United States would not have to fulfill those generous commitments that they'd made in terms of the energy aid and the light water reactors. So, you know, they were operating on a false assumption. Things didn't work out the way that they should have. And subsequently, the Bush administration's policy has been the six-party talks, which really are designed simply to try and pressure North Korea to give up its nuclear threat. And the North Korean regime will never do that, because that would really lead to the end of that regime. And so because the Bush administration has been probably occupied elsewhere in the Middle East, Afghanistan, and Iraq, they haven't really been focusing on North Korea sufficiently, and the situation continues to fester, and now it seems to be getting even worse.
I bet they're focusing on it now. Oral, you wanted to say.
Well, I'm glad Charles said that the U.S. is not to blame, because that would be overly simplistic. And I think there's also a danger of conducting diplomacy by self-flagellation. these kind of notions that it's all a rational actor model, that somehow, you know, we use this kind of Gramscian approach or some constructive ideational approach, is not working. This is a very Machiavellian situation. If you work your way back from today, it's fairly clear that North Korea was violating the agreement from the very beginning. You don't reach the stage of nuclear weapons development only after 2002. So the idea that this only happened because Clinton didn't go and visit, it only happened because they did not have a direct dialogue, although I must tell you that within the six-party meeting, they had bilateral dialogues anytime they wanted to. They had several of these meetings. And when you look at what the problem was, well, the policy of sunshine by South Korea, that seems to have failed. That was a constructive engagement. It did not yield the results. The gentle nudging by Japan, that did not yield results. The Chinese were engaged, kept open the borders, and helped North Korea provide fuel. They now have made the Chinese lose a tremendous amount of face.
Well, if the Chinese had not threatened to cut off their fuel, they wouldn't have even sat down for the six-party talks. So we're acting as if North Korea is a real government run by pragmatic people, and they're not pragmatic. They don't function that way, and they don't function the way Americans or Japanese or the Chinese expect them to, because they have a different agenda.
But Wen Rengjiang, some people have argued that ever since George W. Bush announced his axis of evil, of which North Korea, he said, was a charter member, they moved more actively to produce nuclear weapons, and therefore the United States, to that extent, has some culpability in this situation. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that. Although the situation is quite complicated, I agree with other colleagues. This is an interactive, complicated process. Remembering all the discussions leading to this, in 1998, North Korea actually launched a missile over Japan, which basically prompted Japan to back out part of that agreement program reached by Clinton administration. And there is no doubt that the Bush administration coming in 2001 after 9/11 labeled North Korea a part of the axis of evil, rogue state, later on, you know, outpost of tyranny. To North Koreans, the issue is really about security. So there's a lot of blame games going on today, an argument whether the United States should have bilaterally engaged North Korea or not. I think that missed the point. Bilaterally or multilaterally, the key point for North Korea is to seek that kind of security guarantee that Washington seems to be very reluctant to give, especially under the Bush administration. And they walked away and they see the Saddam Hussein Iraq situation, because U.S. just walk in without considering of any international law and saying you have weapons of mass destruction, I'll just go into it. So they thought either to be regime changed or to have the nuclear weapons. So they chose the latter.
Okay, let's move into the second segment of our discussion here. And since we've been talking about George W. Bush, how is the world going to prevent the proliferation of nuclear weapons? One of the questions for the ages. Here's what the president had to say about this yesterday. Roll tape.
The United States condemns this provocative act. Once again, North Korea has defied the will of the international community, and the international community will respond. This was confirmed this morning in conversations I had with leaders of China and South Korea, Russia, and Japan.
Well, Charles Burton, could this really have been prevented?
Well, I don't think that we need to obsess about what went wrong in the past. I'm really more interested in what we can do to try and stop this proliferation you're talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, the current situation, North Korea now has a bomb. I think that this will strengthen forces in places like Japan and South Korea and Taiwan. The elements that would like to see those countries also have nuclear weaponry. The South Koreans had a program that was aborted in the 1970s. And so I think what we have to worry about is whether this is going to lead to increasing tensions, whether the U.S. would decide to, say, station more troops in Japan and South Korea, thereby exacerbating the situation, and whether Japan will become more aggressive militarily, which will distress China. And, you know, the whole thing will kind of snowball into an even worse international dynamic than what we're facing today.
David DeWitt, here's what the Chinese ambassador to the United Nations had to say about this today. I think there has to be some punitive actions, but I also think these actions have to be appropriate. What does that mean?
Well, we're facing a real struggle with the issue of sanctions against North Korea. we have enough experience to know that the North Korean government is quite prepared to allow their population to suffer even more, and to suffer in the most extraordinary ways, including tens of thousands of dead, as has happened in the past. That doesn't mean that they're not rational. It means that they have a very particular or peculiar view of the world. They have very limited experience, and they have a very defined goal and sense of threat from outside.
So sanctions would be
and
useless,
so,
is that right?
I'm not saying sanctions would be useless. I think that they have to be targeted, and they have to be carefully orchestrated, and we have to think of the kinds that might work. Certainly, as was mentioned earlier, the issue of managing the flow of petroleum from China. Also, issue of access to international banking facilities, primarily again through China, but also elsewhere in Asia. Access to technology, spare parts, food. Again, most of it through China.
You've been there.
Yes.
You've been there, what, a couple of times?
Yes. A
couple of times. Would any of that catch the attention of the regime?
The regime, yes. People, I think, continue to be extraordinarily committed to the Juche ideal, the idea of resilience, and the idea that the rest of the world is out to get them, and the idea that South Korea is simply an extension of the United States, and the United States is an imperialist power that is determined to destroy North Korea. And that's where something like sanctions is on the one hand, it's unavoidable because one has to show some concerted commitment to punishing proliferators, especially in this particular way, and the Chinese have made some very strong statements about that. And at the same time, we have to be realistic.
Go ahead, Charles.
But
just to back up on David's point, you know, this nuclear test will undoubtedly increase the prestige of Kim Jong-il inside North Korea because, you know, setting off a nuclear bomb will strengthen nationalistic pride in that nation, and it'll make them stronger against any kind of economic sanctions. But I do think that if China and South Korea are pressured to try and reduce the food aid and the energy aid, that this, in fact, could make the situation worse. One-third of the population is dependent on foreign food inputs. If you squeeze them economically and led to a breakdown in that regime, certainly it's quite likely that Kim Jong-il would fall. But the consequences domestically in terms of maybe break up into military zones and warlords and unstable people who might, in fact, set off some of those weapons in foreign places would be too horrendous to imagine. So I think the best we can do is to try and target the elite. You know, the Americans are talking about things like stopping luxury goods from going into North Korea and trying to prevent North Korea from selling out weapons to other undesirable elements such as Iran, possibly Al-Qaeda, or, you know, smaller weapons to factions in Africa. But it's all very problematic. You know, the interdiction of North Korean shipping on the international waters really could be seen as tantamount to a declaration of war. And so how the North Koreans will respond to anything that's being talked about is very hard to establish.
Oral, and then Brian, please.
I'm always very concerned when I hear that we know what the people think, whether we visit or read about it in a totalitarian state. We don't, because people cannot express their views. They live in terror. What we've learned in the transition states is that the populations, whether it was in Hungary or East Germany or in Poland or in Bulgaria, seem to express one opinion when they were under coercion and had entirely different opinions elsewhere. And I think this is the problem in North Korea, that the kind of security that the Kim Jong-il regime wants is not just from the outside, the threat from the outside, but they want somehow guaranteed that the threat from the inside to them will also be repulsed. And that cannot be given. That cannot make sense.
Mm. So probably
and consequently, I think when we look at what can be done vis-a-vis this regime, no regime lasts forever. And we don't just need sanctions. What we need is basically a quarantine. And this is what the Americans are beginning to talk about. And there are risks in that quarantine. But every regime has a breaking point. And perhaps at some point what the Chinese can say to them is, it's over. Maybe we'll offer you political asylum to the top leaders. Maybe this is the way out. Because a starving population, a continually deprived population, and increasingly, if a quarantine is introduced, the regime itself, which has thousands and tens of thousands of supporters, the privilege, if they begin to lose their privilege, they're not getting those supplies, then that confidence, that tipping point occurs.
Except that all this is a guy who said, if I go down, I'm taking the whole world with me.
Well, if you assume that he's irrational, then you have two choices, fight or flee. Because if you assume that he's irrational, he's suicidal, we take the nation down, no amount of concessions, no amount of dialogue will make any sense.
Brian, I want to hear from you on Oral's idea of quarantine. Is that a legitimate option?
Well, it is. And I mean, the UN could certainly enforce that if China agrees. And the key to this whole issue, as far as I'm concerned, is China. Sanctions by themselves wouldn't work even if the Chinese supported them. But a quarantine would, and cutting off fuel really would have a major impact, especially going into the cold winter months. And it's really miserable weather there in the winter. So on top of all the other issues, the key is how much pressure can they bring on the government of North Korea without knocking it down? Because the Chinese are scared to death of the chaos that would follow if this regime falls. And that's what's kept them from doing anything until now, I think.
But I would suggest that, you know, the elite will still have lots of food and lots of heat. It's going to be the people in North Korea who are already suffering from living in one of the most repressive regimes on earth that's not able to provide them with food security and adequate energy that will really bear the brunt of this.
I would say without the fuel, though, they're not going to be able to run their military vehicles. They're not going to be able to do the things they need to do.
I wonder if I could come back into the central theme of the second element segment you're introducing about the international context of non-proliferation. Just a couple of points. One, we have to remember our viewers should be informed that there is a double standard going on by the world community at large, by the United States especially, regarding proliferation. In 1998, both Pakistan and India did exactly the same, exploded the nuclear weapons doing the test. After a few months of sanctions, now both are being back onto the normal track, rewarded by the Bush administration for cooperation. Actually, India has more cooperation with the United States in the nuclear area, and Pakistan is hailed as an ally in anti-terror war.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, we have relations with those countries, so maybe that's what gives us a little more comfort to allow what has happened to have happened, but there's no relationship with North Korea, thus...
That actually is the point. You need to develop that relationship. Why the sanctions has to be the only way to deal with North Korea?
Well, what would
Why
you suggest?
Why not, pressing for talks, direct talks, bilateral, multilateral? Now, actually, the second point I want to make is that Bush himself has made it clear, now they're backing up, basically saying, if you have nuclear weapons, you try to proliferate, to sell or to give to others, then the United States will take the issue as a very serious matter. So tactically, basically, they're ready to live with a nuclear North Korea. Christopher Hill, Assistant Secretary for Asia-Pacific Affairs, only a few days ago saying that the North Koreans either have nuclear weapons or a future, but not both. Now, what do you do with it? The sanctions will cut off the luxury goods. How much does that really hurt the elites? As colleagues mentioned, that the nation has already so much sanctioned, and you need to find creative engagement approaches of talking and trying to talk them out and reverse the course. I think that is a better way of anti-proliferation.
Well, David DeWitt, I heard Sam Nunn, the former senator from Georgia, say today that he worried less about people with addresses having nuclear weapons, in other words, a country that you could attack back, and he worried more about those weapons getting in the hands of other people who did not have addresses. Isn't that really the big problem with North Korea, is who they might sell these things to as opposed to who they might use them against?
Well, that's certainly the big problem in the context of the issue of proliferation, which you were asking before. There's a history of North Korea developing weapon systems for export. It's been a very important part of their hard currency. It's been a very important part of their diplomacy and their politics and their status. And this is no different, with the exception that this is the weapon that they have been warning the Americans they would bring forth. And many people who have been watching this for some time have argued that their principal concern was finally getting the attention of the United States. That if you look at the history of North Korea's engagement on a whole host of things, every time it comes down to wanting to finalize a relationship with the United States, having a bilateral discussion to end what they consider was an act of belligerency by the United States.
So should Bush go there?
And, you know, it's been a highly contested issue with lots of interpretation.
Okay, but should Bush go there?
I don't think Bush should go there now. I think there was an opportunity, and perhaps at some time there will be an opportunity. Six-party talks was important because, as Oral had said earlier, there were some side payments to participating in this regional multilateralism, and that was a number of bilaterals. And the other part of the that made it so important was that it gave China the position which it had never had before of really delivering on the diplomatic security dialogue in Northeast Asia and being a facilitator, bringing the North Koreans and the Americans together. There is some argument that says, you know, now the North Koreans have finally got the American attention again, and if the Chinese can do their magic, perhaps if there's patience, there will be an opportunity.
Hold off on China. That's section three of our discussion. Oral, you wanted to say.
There's a problem making this into a bilateral crisis rather than the fact that it is a multilateral crisis.
That's what the Americans say. They don't want to
And so, you know, this kind of notion, United States with a double standard, you know, of course, India did not sign the non-proliferation treaty. India is a democracy. So to compare India to this monstrous, murderous regime, I think is profoundly unfair.
Let me get Wen Renjiang on that. He's just basically said you're all wet on that point. What do you say?
Well, I think...
Your words.
Those are my words. Fair enough. Yeah.
Okay. I think the issue here, there is an issue of legitimacy involved. Somehow people feel they're comfortable enough. The India now has it, maybe rational not to use it. Pakistan, well, on the border because now it's an ally of the United States. Even if you doubt if it's a democracy, it's actually quite dangerous, the situation there. For North Korea, I think the Kim Il-sung regime is still quite rational in this regard. I mean, if you look at the behavior, they've been developing this program for about half a century. They're pursuing this for a long time, persistent. And now they have the weapon. And of course, there's a distance between now exploding, if it has one, between now and putting it on the warhead, or to put it very small, to be carried as a dirty bomb to nuclear to terrorists. So I think this is still a window of opportunity to talk to North Korea. I mean, there are still ways of saying if you reverse the cost.
Well, let's see.
Of course, to get out of this, we can talk.
Understood. Charles Burton, tell me this. In terms of who can talk to North Korea right now, somebody sent an email to us today at tvo.org/theagenda. Following question: what's the significance of the UN's probable new Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon of South Korea, being able to move the yardsticks forward on this?
Well, I guess he is a Korean, which has got to be something good. Of course, the fact that it's the foreign minister of South Korea, the regime, as David pointed out, that the North Koreans regard as an illegitimate puppet state of the United States, is probably perceived by the North Korean regime as yet another humiliation towards North Korea. But, you know, he can speak to them in their own language. He does have a good understanding. And certainly they would be happy to collaborate with someone of their own ethnicity. And he's also already indicated that he would like to go to North Korea, which is something that the previous Secretary General did not do. So I think that that's got to be, on the whole, a good development. But, you know, it's then again, you really have to come up with some sort of scenario of how we're going to resolve this. And the only scenario I can think of is that regime undergo a transition to something more like the transition that China experienced after they had a faltering economy and a personality cult based on Chairman Mao in 1978. But for the North Koreans, they realized that the people who were leaders in China in 1976, once they did the reform and opening, lost their power. So from that point of view, for this small elite in North Korea, the Chinese transition example is a negative example. But I still think it's the direction that's most likely to work out in that country.
In which case, let's talk about China right now. And to that end, I don't know how many of you have had a chance to look at the Atlantic magazine this month, October 2006. Robert Kaplan's got a fascinating piece in there about all of what we've talked about tonight. And here's a quote from that article. Robert Kaplan says, Kim doesn't stay up at night worrying about what the Americans might do to him. It's not North Korea's weakness relative to the United States that preoccupies him. Rather, if he does stay up late worrying, it's about China. Yeah. He knows the Chinese have always had a greater interest in North Korea's geography, with its additional outlets to the sea close to Russia, than they have had in the long-term survival of his regime. One of Kim's main goals is in so aggressively displaying North Korea's missile capacity, it is to compel the United States to deal directly with him, thereby making his otherwise weakening state seem stronger. And the stronger Pyongyang appears to be, the better off it is in its crucial dealings with Beijing, which are what really matters to Kim. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing a lot of heads nodding.
Well, I think he's right to an extent. But it's not just China, because they're missing out on Japan. Whenever you think of China, you have to think of Japan as well. Japan, under Abe right now, is also concerned about the power of China, about the growth of influence of China, and they're worried about North Korea. And if Japan begins to spend a lot more on armaments, this will, as a result of this crisis, this will impact on China. So it's at least a trilateral kind of
picture. Okay, understood.
Picture.
But I want to follow
that
sense. I want to follow the Chinese angle here a second. David, tell me this. If North Korea and China are supposed to be friends, why is China so concerned about North Korea having the bomb?
You don't really have friends in diplomacy.
You have interests.
You have interests, right.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Right?
Okay.
No. The Chinese, as Oral correctly said, and I don't always agree with Mr. Kaplan, but I think he's, well, more or less. China is the important factor, both in terms of the one country that might at some time be able to have more influence. And when you speak to senior Chinese diplomats who've been dealing with North Korea for a very long time, and Charles was in Beijing a number of times, and I think would probably agree with this, that the Chinese say, you in the West, you think we have the influence, but there are so many times that we'd want them to act this way, and they don't, and we really are very, very constrained.
Let me pursue
let me just add one point. They are constrained because the North Koreans can do a great deal to disrupt the Chinese movement, their movement in terms of economic development, economic openness, a sense of political stability, and opportunity for investment. And they're concerned at the extent to which China will have to pick up the pieces of massive refugees, of an imploded North Korean economy. And if that were to happen, they're equally concerned about a unified, strong South Korea.
Well, this is Wen Rengjiang. I want to bring you back in because, of course, China is a growing power. It is keen to portray itself as a responsible member of the international community. It is keen to play a role in the region. It is the only country in the world right now, we suspect, that can have any direct influence on North Korea. So how well has it played this scenario?
I agree with David's assessment here. China, with all the perceived leverage over North Korea, its influence has always been limited, even back in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. The North Koreans do not like to be seen as patrons, small partners. They want to see equals with Chinese. That's why recently, when China moved away closer in its position on North Korean crisis towards Washington, Tokyo, the North Koreans are actually quite angered. Maybe that actually contributed in part to the explosion of the nuclear test. The Chinese ambassador to UN virtually said nobody is going to protect that kind of bad behavior when North Korea declared that they wanted to test a nuclear weapon. That one is perceived to be very badly. Look here, neither China nor North Korea is a monolithic bloc. On how to deal with North Korea, the Chinese have extensive debate internally. They know they have limited leverage. And they also, some people suggest that maybe it's better, as Mr. Kaplan's thesis, actually, there's a Chinese academic agree with that, saying there is a North Korea, hostile, strong, survive, and in confrontation with the South, with the United States, as a balance over Taiwan issue, as a bargaining chip. There are others saying don't play that kind of dangerous game, because North Korea is a dangerous regime as we know it. So the Chinese are actually debating very, very intensely among themselves. And the recent shifts and the angry language expressed is actually a reflection of different opinions over time. At this moment, Chinese seems to be both very angry and confused. But I think they have a difficult time in moving into next steps.
Okay, I've got just a few minutes left.
Yes. I think Wen Rang is absolutely right on this, and to take it one step further, it's not so much the Chinese are concerned that this will give the Japanese an argument for a military buildup. They have an enormous military capacity, and they're starting to shift some of their domestic law to allow them to use it in various ways. It's more that it creates further opening for an American reintroduction or recommitment and strengthening of American position, both with the South Koreans and with the Japanese. Missile defense is therefore, theater missile defense in Northeast Asia is now proven from that perspective, and it makes it more difficult for the Chinese to engage the Americans in their long-term strategic interests, and by that I mean both security and economic.
Brian, the Chinese have wanted to be players. How do they play?
Well,
this?
The Chinese are players. I mean, they have moved closer to the American position in a lot of ways, and they are much closer to them on the North Korean situation now than they've ever been before. And I think that's a sign that, that there are pressures on the Chinese leadership to do something about this, because the risks to China are much greater than they are to Japan right now. I think that if there's any conflict in that region, it could well be between China and North Korea.
Isn't that ironic, given what happened 50 years ago?
No, I think that with the six-party talks, I think China was hoping that they could gain some leverage with the United States on Taiwan. Now the thing has not turned out well, and I would agree that if North Korea was to set off a nuclear bomb in any foreign place, the most likely place would be China, because China has betrayed North Korea from the North Korean point of view.
Charles, what do you think the lessons the Chinese leadership are drawing from the last 48 hours?
Well, I think that they realize that they surely will have to realize that, that they've got to do something about the Kim regime. That the Kim regime existing there for strategic purposes, as the others have mentioned, you know, as a buffer between a U.S. South Korea, and as a way for China to try and manipulate the North Korean situation to benefit its passion to reunify with Taiwan, is not working out. And I think that they really should be looking at potential agents of change inside the North Korean military and trying to strengthen those elements so that there can be a transition from this current really hopeless regime to something that might be a bit more acceptable to the international community, and one that would do better by the suffering Korean people.
On that somewhat optimistic note, I guess, Charles Burton in Hamilton, thanks so much for being there on the
Thank
line
you.
For us from the Steel City. Wenrang Zhang from Edmonton, good to have you on the program tonight as well. David, Brian, Oral, thanks for being here in Toronto with us as well.
Thank you.